Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
A very good evening to you. Welcome. My name's Tony Travers from the Department of Government and the School of Public Policy here at the LSE, but actually this is a public event hosted by the LSE's excellent European Institute. I'm very pleased to be joined by our speakers, who I'll introduce in a moment, to this event, which is to mark the 10 years passing since the Brexit referendum in June. We're slightly 10 years and a month now. And this has been noted by a new book edited by Anthony Seldon called The Brexit Effect, with an array of authors, who I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. I wish you just asked, make sure you all have your phones on silent. There's a hashtag for those of you who use those kind of things. There'll be an opportunity after the presentations for you to ask questions of our speakers. And what we're going to do is, so I'm going to ask each of them, and I've introduced them, to say a few words about why the book was written, why they wrote what they did in the book, what they've learned from this remarkable experience. Because, and of course we all know that the UK's decision in that remarkable referendum to leave the European Union was perhaps the most divisive and consequential event, even more certainly across the UK. I mean, analogous to what had happened in Scotland in 2014, with many similar impacts, but these across the UK. It was an amazing and extraordinary event, which Anthony Seldon's new book, The Brexit Effect, brings together a roll call of Brexit insiders and commentators on both sides of the debate to analyse why the referendum happened, how Brexit became law, which, remember all of that, the remarkable period that was in our history, and its impact subsequently on every corner of British life, concluding with a range of perspectives on how Britain might make the most of the opportunities, for those of you who thought there were opportunities, now available to it. Personally, I've always been intrigued by how, just add a personal night thought here, how difficult it's proved to change things, which I think many people thought, whether they supported Brexit or opposed it, might happen afterwards. But we'll doubtless be looking and discussing that in a moment. So who are our speakers? First, not in this order, but Steve Baker has 30 years of leadership experience spanning military, aerospace engineering, private sector software engineering, parliament and government. He's a Privy Councillor, Fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, was previously the MP for Wickham for 14 years, including serving as a minister in the Cabinet Office, Northern Ireland Office, Department for exiting the European Union, and ran a number of notable campaigns as a backbench MP. Anand Menon, Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London, our dear friends next door. He's the long-term director of UK in a Changing Europe, the independent think tank communicating social science research on Brexit and the Brexit process to non-academic audiences. He's an associate fellow of Chatham House, senior associate of Nuffield College, Oxford, and has written books too many to read out. Not as many too many to read out as Anthony Seldon. I mean that very kindly.
Half of them, Tony.
I've actually written parts of chapters in some of them, it's true. Anthony is the country's top political historian and acknowledged national authority on matters to do with the government and Number 10. He's written or edited many books. I won't read them all out. And has been the honorary historian at Number 10 Downing Street. You'll be using Avanti trains, I'm guessing, a little bit more in future to visit Manchester. Chair of the National Archives Trust. And has interviewed virtually all senior figures who've worked in Number 10. There'll be one more soon in the last 50 years, or more than one. And last but not least, Madeline Sumption, I'm doing this alphabetically, is director of the Migration Observatory at the University of Oxford, which provides impartial analysis of migration in the UK. All of you will have read Migration Observatory and Madeleine's work. It is used again and again and again by the media. She's interim chair of the Migration Advisory Committee, which advises the UK government on migration, and is also chair of the National Statisticians Advisory Panel on Migration Statistics. In 2017, she received an MBE for Services to Social Science. So, what we're going to do now is I'm going to go and sit over there. I'm going to ask each of our speakers in alphabetical order to speak for 4 or 5-ish minutes. Then we'll have a bit of a discussion, and then you can join the discussion. I'm told there are those watching online who may be contributing questions, but if that's true, somebody's going to have to bring them to me, because unless they're on the table there, I won't know what they are. Anyway, welcome people online as well. Right. Alphabetically, Steve, it's you.
Speaking from here or speaking from there?
You sit where you're most comfortable.
Well, I'm sitting here, so I'll speak from here. First of all, thank you all very much indeed for being here. I really appreciate the opportunity to come to this august institution to see such a sea of faces. It's a huge privilege. It's a privilege to be in Anthony's book with one of your professors, Professor Paul Dolan, a behavioural scientist. And I know I am the nominated Brexiteer this evening. Let me tell you, I have observed the position of the exit doors. Paul, of course, voted Remain and would normally vote Labour. He and I are different characters as well, but we get on famously, which is why we've started a business together called The Provocation People, partly inspired by Brexit, as I'd like to briefly explain. I've got really two confessions for you this evening. The first confession, really, is that I'm an introvert who doesn't much like conflict. Now, I know you wouldn't know that from watching me on the TV, but I can promise you it's true. When I said I was going into politics, my family said, you know, are you going to be okay? And I'll be honest, I nearly wasn't. But I really believe very strongly in what I did, so I want to come back to that. But precisely because of that, perhaps partly also because of my faith, the extent of the division which our country has suffered has really caused me the utmost horror. And so I've done a number of things about it. On the night we left the European Union, I made a speech of sufficient emollients about it that I received a, I didn't expect to receive a prize for it, but I got a prize, Civility in Public Life Award, Politician of the Year. It's why I made a very carefully crafted apology to Ireland, which unlocked our relationship with them, allowed the Windsor framework to happen, which, though it's not perfect from my point of view, it is progress. But I talked about humility and resolve. It was only really the humility that was heard very publicly, sorry. But there was also resolve, which I'll answer questions about if you like. But I wanted to set things right with Ireland, and it did have a substantial impact. I was written up as the unlikeliest doyen of British-Irish relations, which gave me some pleasure. And it's why I work with Paul Dolan, because we'd like to help everybody put in place the institutions, the arrangements necessary to help us move on as a country and collaborate, even if as adversaries. The second confession... it's really, I did not understand the behavioural science of how people make decisions. If I may, I'll very briefly tell you how I became a Eurosceptic. I read the Constitution for Europe. I thought, that's terribly bureaucratic, I don't like it. That converted me from being a federalist. I was in favour of a fully federal EU and joining the Euro. And then I read the Constitution, I thought, it's too bureaucratic for me. But at least I'll get a vote in the referendum. Of course, they cancelled the referenda when voters rejected the Constitution. The Lisbon Treaty came forward. Thanks to Open Europe, I read the two side by side. It was plain to me they were functionally equivalent. And it was a device to avoid a referendum. And it was in that moment that I really became a Eurosceptic, because I absolutely insist that political power can be dismissed peacefully at the ballot box, as Karl Popper said, because if you can't do it peacefully at the ballot box, you have to do it the other way. That's why democracy is important. That's why all of this has been important to me. So that is why I hugely regret all the division, because actually I can see the other person's point of view, because for a long time I was in favour of a federal European Union. So I must stop. The final point I want to make is a great realignment is in progress in our politics, and it's not only in the UK. I don't doubt Brexit has contributed to identity and culture and nationalism being the main axis of our politics, but it's not responsible for it happening in East Germany or the United States or France or Italy or a range of other countries like India. So there's a great realignment has happened in politics, and there's a brilliant book by Steve Davies on that. But finally, I just really, my main point to you all tonight, I think it's time for thoughtful people of good faith to be turning their minds and their hearts and their instinct to how can we all move on together to create a better future.
Very good. Thank you very much. And
Thanks, Tony. Hi, everyone. I wrote the chapter in the book about what Brexit did to our politics. I found it very hard reflecting on the whole 10 years of Brexit because I was so immersed in the detail that the big picture stuff sometimes eludes me. But I think, and also I think my comments are going to be basically about the politics in England, but if you've got questions about Scotland or Northern Ireland or Wales, I'm happy to answer them. I think we suffer a little bit in this country from a 2016 fixation, which is that it's too easy to think in 2016 the world changed, and for a lot of people in 2016 the world became worse and it was perfectly fine beforehand. And I think actually that's just wrong. And the interesting thing about our politics is that Brexit was both cause and consequence of longer-term trends going on in our politics. It was consequence because there had developed, particularly since 2008 when we had the great financial crisis, followed by the MPs' expenses, followed by the impact of austerity, a sense that for many people politics wasn't working. Already in 2015 we had an election with the lowest ever vote share garnered by the Labour and Conservative parties. Politics was changing in front of our eyes. We didn't look at it. Actually, one of the most interesting things that happened in our politics between 2010 and 2015 was the nature of the Labour vote changed fundamentally. They lost white working class voters. They gained young graduates. So in a sense, some of the things we've seen post-Brexit and we attribute to Brexit were happening before Brexit anyway. And there are that realignment of our politics that took on greater urgency after the referendum was already going on. So partly, do not forget that it was only because there was a sense of disillusionment with mainstream politics already there in 2016 that actually the Leave campaign got over the line. So it's not the case that 2016 marks the start of our period of discontent, quite the contrary. But Brexit is also a cause, and it was a cause because one of the things it did was it took that realignment, that values division that existed, because Brexit triggered a division between social liberals and social conservatives. Steve talked about the realignment, which was very different to the division between left and right-wing politics that used to characterise our politics, and it basically meant values determined how you voted, class didn't. There's a guy called Chris Curtis, who's now a Labour MP, who at the time worked for YouGov, who wrote a piece on the YouGov website straight after the 2017 election, saying back in the 1960s, Peter Pulitzer, who was a great Oxford professor of political science, wrote a piece that basically said everything about British politics can be explained in terms of class. Chris Curtis wrote in 2017, knowing someone's class would tell you as much about how they vote nowadays as reading their palms. And this was Brexit. Brexit created two new tribes, Leavers and Remainers, and those tribes became and have remained stronger identities for more people in this country than traditional political identities. It's still the case now, even when no one was really talking about Brexit apart from me, that more people have a Leave or Remain identity than have a party political identity. And that realignment led to all the sorts of electoral shocks we've seen. We had to get used to saying things like Jeremy Corbyn wins Kensington, or the Conservative Party wins Stoke. The sort of stuff that you would never in your wildest dreams have thought you were going to say happened because Brexit realigned the electorate. And the other impact of, I mean, and actually that realignment continues to confuse people. And there's a real sense now that our main political parties no longer know who they are for. If you want an example of that, Al Carnes, who for a very short time sort of fancied himself as a future prime minister, in his resignation speech in Parliament gave the most remarkable speech about miners, about dockers, as the bedrock of the Labour movement. Those people no longer vote Labour. Those people haven't voted Labour for an awfully long time. If Al Carnes wanted to make that speech and be honest about it, he'd have talked about young Liberal graduates in cities. It doesn't have the same ring to it. But actually, one of the things that is haunting our politics at the moment is both Labour and the Conservatives are trying to figure out who they are for, because it is not as clear as it used to be in the time when class would give you all the answers. The other point I would make is that Brexit facilitated the rise of populism. And it did it in many ways. It did it partly by setting the will of the people, as it came to be known from a referendum, against a parliament the majorities of whose members voted Remain. It was facilitated by the actions of some of our political leaders. I still remember, I think I'll remember till the day I die, Theresa May taking to our TV screens the night of the second meaningful vote, addressing the people of this country and basically blaming Parliament for the fact that everything had gone wrong. It was straight up populism. Populism was nurtured by the way in which Boris Johnson's regime played fast and loose with international law. So I don't think you can draw a direct line from Brexit to the populism that we see in our politics on both left and right at the moment. You can certainly draw a dotted line. So in that sense, as in many others, Brexit has reshaped politics, continues to do so to this day, and I suspect will continue to do so for many years to come.
Very good. Thank you, Anna. Now, I was going to go alphabetically, and I'm afraid I've teed everybody up this way, but actually, given, Anthony, you were the editor of this excellent volume, perhaps Madeline, would you mind speaking next, and Anthony sure. last? I think it would make more sense, if that's okay with both of you.
Yes. So the question that I address in my chapter of this excellent tome is why the impact of Brexit on migration was so radically different from what everyone expected. So, you know, go back to 2016, all of the debates were about how leaving the European Union would reduce migration. And that was a completely standard thing to say. It was the consensus among experts. It was, you know, what people expected, many people who voted to leave. And it was absolutely not what happened. What we saw, if you look at net migration, so the number of people coming in minus the number of people leaving, which is the metric that we somewhat quirkily use in this country, the figures, the level of net migration basically tripled under the post-Brexit immigration system. So it was completely unexpected. Now, what the modelling had suggested, and what I solidly thought before Brexit happened, was that there would be a dramatic reduction in EU migration as a result of ending free movement, and that was one of the major reasons that many people voted to leave. And that there would then be some increase in non-EU migration because the government was proposing some liberalisations, but that the decrease in EU migration would be bigger. Now, what happened was actually the increase in non-EU migration was much, much, much bigger than anyone anticipated. And I think that the reason for this basically was it was sort of partly by accident and partly by design. So the design bit was there were some liberalisations, and some of them, with hindsight, you can see. Well, I think it was difficult to predict how big their impacts were going to be because migration is quite unpredictable. These liberalisations then generated a lot of enthusiasm among prospective migrants, much more than anticipated, right? So you had, for example, there was a liberalisation of the post-study work route. Many of the students in this room may well be familiar with it. And that on its own wouldn't necessarily have had a huge impact. We'd had that same regime in the past. It had been accompanied by massive numbers of students coming to the UK. But then universities started to recruit more aggressively abroad for various other reasons, including inflation and the fact that they were under more financial pressure, and non-EU students paid, overseas students paid higher fees. So these things combined together, and actually the post-study work regime made it much easier for universities, particularly less selective institutions, to persuade international students to sign up with them. So there were a number of things like this where basically there was a liberalisation, but the response to it was much bigger than the government expected. Probably the single biggest one was the care route. So there was a concern after the end of free movement. There had been lots of EU citizens coming, working in the care sector, working very hard. There was a lot of concern about how the care sector was going to function without them. So then, in part to sort of mitigate these problems that the government was seeing, it opened up a route for care workers. Now, the internal projections at the time suggested that maybe there would be a few thousand people, maybe something up to the low tens of thousands of care workers might come to the UK. In practice, it was more than 300,000 people, once you include the family members of the care workers, over a quite short period of, you know, a couple of years, particularly in 2023. And anyway, there are lots of debates about, you know, could it have been regulated differently? Yes, it could. But that piece of it, I think, was genuinely unexpected. So that's the sort of accidental piece, I think, that there was an expectation of a modest increase in non-EU migration, and instead we got a really, really big increase. Until, of course, then towards the end of the previous government, that a lot of those liberalisations were then reversed, and the numbers came back down again. There's one area, I think, that's being particularly controversial and where I think it's difficult to know what the impact has been on migration, and that's the asylum system, and particularly people coming in small boats from France. And the reason that there's some uncertainty, so the argument in favour of there being some impact is effectively, we used to be part of this system called the Dublin system, where the UK could send people back, in theory, could send people back to EU countries if they had claimed asylum there, if they'd passed through on the way. Now, in practice, the UK didn't actually tend to do that very much. The system was very bureaucratic. It was actually quite difficult to send people back. Sometimes they would run people's fingerprints in the database, which should, in theory, have included them, but there were no hits. There was a relatively small number of hits. So that system didn't actually seem to do very much for the UK while the UK was part of it. Afterwards, there is this slightly surprising evidence that researchers go to northern France and they interview people who are in Calais trying to get across. And actually, to my surprise, many of these people say, we're coming because of the UK's not in these arrangements with the EU anymore. And so you've got people who've actually been refused asylum in Europe and who, under the old rules, might have just been immediately removable. But because the UK doesn't know that they've been refused asylum, they can get a new asylum decision in the UK. So that, I think, there's really... I think it would be completely wrong to say, small boats is happening because of Brexit. I think that would be a massive exaggeration. Obviously, it started before Brexit. The numbers increased afterwards, and there are lots of other reasons that they might have increased. But I think that it is probably the case that that Brexit contributed to some extent. It was not the reason for the very significant increase in overall migration we saw, which was largely driven by work and study. So I think the overall sort of conclusion, what was the impact of Brexit, was that actually what we saw was not an inevitable consequence of Brexit. It was a consequence of the way that Brexit was managed by Boris Johnson's administration and the immigration policies that they introduced. But ultimately, the UK chose those immigration policies. It could have chosen completely different ones. So there's an alternative universe in which the reality would have been extremely different.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Madeline?
Anthony? So, first of all, thank you everyone for being here, and it's fantastic to see full house here on a hot July evening, and thank you very much everyone for coming. And can I also just say thanks to the authors? I mean, 43 is a lot. Thomas Tuchel, however you pronounce him, had only 11, and he managed to muck it up. And I had 43, and they were beautiful players to be with. And on the right wing, I had Steve, and on the left, Anand, and then coming up to the middle, the academic, the balance from Madeline. And, I wanted, some people said, why am I going to have people like Douglas Carswell, who is neo-fascist? Well, I don't know. He actually was... He was responsible for a lot of the early momentum towards it. Let's hear him. Let's give a voice to it. And I love the diversity of people. It's a passion. I'm so excited about producing that book that has voices from all over. I mean, Rowan Williams, former Archbishop of Canterbury, writing, Susan Greenfield, David Marquand, David Miliband. It was great to have that range of people, and then letting people make their own minds up. Look, I was a Remainer. I was so frustrated with a lot about the EU, including the bureaucracy, the regulation, but at heart, and I don't know what it's about. I mean. I think maybe it's partly family. My father, Jewish, came from Ukraine. A family emigrated from the pogroms. I just feel European in my blood as much as I feel British. And he came to LSE, by the way. He loved LSE. I came down from somewhere else to LSE for my doctorate. Brilliant. My son came here. We love LSE. It's a great place. And can I also say the publisher, Cambridge, were, I mean, unimaginably good. I have a friend called Vernon Bogdanor, who took 5 years recovering from editing a book. He said it was the worst academic experience he'd ever had, worst experience of any kind in his life. I said, how many people did you have? He said, 8. He said they were a total nightmare. Cambridge just brought them all through. So when the result came out that day, 23rd of June 2016, I was walking across Europe and creating a path of peace all the way from the North Sea initially to Switzerland, where the First World War ended, and I'd done a second book from there through to Auschwitz, and then the new walk is all the way through to the Ukraine front line. I am interested in what we share in common. I am more interested in what we share in common and what divides us? And what is it that we share in common is something that I think is extraordinarily important. At the time I was angry, I wrote a book anonymously, which was a very angry book. And I asked the question, who's going to benefit? Who has benefited from this? Xi, Putin, Farage, Trump. Are the people going to benefit in the left behind areas? And it's and from this, a lot of people made a lot of money on the election night, on betting on it. A lot of people have made money, a lot of people have lost out. And it's because I think, and I worry about the fabric, the economic, cultural, social fabric of our country, the sense of community, that I think now that I want us to work together, I am no longer interested in scoring points about it. I want to bring people together and find the things that we share in common, and especially for those people who have actually been suffering, as Anand said, for many years, feeling alienated from Westminster and Whitehall, and trying to have a better country, to treasure our democracy, to treasure this country, to treasure its traditions, the country that gave Number 10, that gave Parliament, that gave the civil service, gave so many of the ideas that Trump has now trampled on the 250th anniversary of America coming through our political traditions and European political traditions. This country has so much to give and so much to learn, and I think that Brexit will be a success if it somehow brings us back together. And why Steve is a hero for me, writing this chapter with Paul Dolan, is because he played a key part. I just finished a book about Rishi Sunak, subtitled The Last Conservative Prime Minister, and Steve was in there working, even though, as he said, there were elements of the Windsor framework that he disliked really strongly, but it was a healing. It has allowed direct rule to come back into Northern Ireland. We haven't seen the outbreak of violence. It has allowed a reset in relations with EU from which we can all benefit. So, yeah, so I was quite an angry Remainer, and I'm now a healer and reconciler. And thank you guys for the book. And thank you, Cambridge. Thank you, Heather. Thanks, LSE. That's it.
Thank you, sir.
I think we've heard, certainly from two of the contributors this evening, a certain sort of sense that there's an element of, and it's not unique, obviously, an element of emotion tangled up with all of this. Many political decisions that people make, which party they vote for in a general election or in a council or whatever it is, some of them will be emotional about it, but overwhelmingly, it's a decision based on a sort of complex mixture of, I like what their leader looks like, I like their policies, I don't want to pay more tax, I do want to pay more tax, whatever it is. But the thing about the Brexit vote, and this is something Anna referred to, not from the left, you don't consider yourself on the left, do you, Anna? You
can not today. Centre.
No, not today. Anyway, but it's a sort of, it's produced a new division in politics, in more than politics, but it is so emotional, that will affect politics for decades to come. A bit in the way, question, is this right, politics of the Republic of Ireland after the Irish Free State was created divisions in politics that are still kind of visible. Is that where we've ended up, do you think, any of you, are sort of with an impact on politics, leave and remain, that will visit politics, whatever the parties are? It's still visiting it and will continue to visit it.
One of the things which Paul writes about is effective polarisation, which is what I believe behavioural scientists call it. It starts with something I wish I'd learned about years ago, the fundamental attribution error. We tend to ascribe more moral motives to our own actions than the other person's. So suppose we were to disagree, sir. One doesn't tend to think, well, I wonder, I don't know your name, I'm sorry, but we never tend to, what's your name? What's your name?
Jeff.
We don't tend to think, I wonder if Jeff's got facts that I'm not aware of. I wonder if my facts are actually incomplete. Maybe there's a different perspective I could take on maybe the same facts, or a different set of legitimate preferences I could have for trade-offs. You know, you can get the sort of sense of sensible questions. We don't do that. Psychologically, we tend to go, I'm right, he's wrong, I know I'm good, he's bad. Sorry, Jeff. But I've seen that so often in politics. A lot of the hostility and bile that's poured out on politicians, whether the subject is food banks or Brexit or whatever it is, if you're not in favour of this policy that Labour are putting forward on an opposition day, you must hate starving children and want them to starve. And obviously it's not true. A moment's decent, civilised reflection tells you we will want to see children well fed. And so this problem of effective polarisation is, I think, at the heart of the hostility people have felt. I see it myself on the street. I'll see someone walk round a corner, they're having a lovely day, big smile on their face, and much to my regret, they'll see me and their face will fall. And yeah, it especially happens around Whitehall at kicking out time. But not with the officials I worked with, but by the way. But this is, I think, a massive problem, and I think the roots of the phenomenon that you refer to, Tony, is it is in the behavioural science. So I wish I'd known more about the behavioural science. If I could change one thing, above all, that government leaflet which went out to every household should have had something in ordinary, everyday, accessible terms to prepare the public for what would happen to them psychologically and emotionally as they confronted this huge decision. And if we'd equipped the public to know what they were going to go through, they might have reacted better to what was a momentous decision.
Thank you very much. Anna, any thoughts on that one?
I mean, Brexit's not the whole story, is it? I mean, if you want to look at the sort of increasing violence, polarisation that we see in politics, I mean, as Steve said earlier, it's happening everywhere. You've got to look at things like social media, you've got to look at things like echo chambers, you've got to look at things like massively disaffected, particularly young men who are very, very online. I mean, there are all sorts of things happening. Brexit was one of the vehicles through which this expressed itself. You must all remember during the Brexit years that if you walked down to College Green, you were just confronted with baying throngs of people sort of shouting and spitting in your face day after day after day. I think Brexit did create a very, very emotional divide in our society, but I think there were other forces that were making politics a little bit coarser than it had been beforehand, independent of Brexit.
Yeah. Anthony, go on.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I think you know, both Stephen and are posing very interesting questions. Most countries have been going through identity and cultural crises. The global financial crisis was mentioned, COVID. It's been a profoundly dislocating period. And therefore, we'd be wrong to put too much stress on Brexit, because other countries have gone through similar anguishes, but without anything quite like Brexit. For all that, Brexit has been the most divisive single issue since 1945, much more so than, say, Suez was cited, or indeed the 2003 reaction to the Blair invasion of Iraq, which was divisive and continued to be divisive. This was profounder, and it affected so much. And part of the problem was the poor implementation. I mean, there was a vote, but what the heck did that vote mean? And what did it mean? And then you had five of the seven prime ministers following the referendum who did not vote for Britain to leave. There were only two Brexit voting prime ministers of the seven. That includes up to Burnham. And you had political class and a civil service class that were unprepared for doing it and didn't quite know what to have happened. You know, there would be a different question, has Brexit been a success, or could Brexit have been a much more of a success had there been a clear plan about executing it and getting the actual benefits that the Brexiteers talked about. So, I mean, it's we're really just beginning to unpick the layers of the onion and getting down to this multifaceted Brexit question.
I mean, one of the things we know, and Madeleine talked about this, that did happen, is that Britain's migration policy changed radically and has now changed radically again. And it changed first because of the UK leaving the EU and the then government coming up with a very different migration policy that hugely increased migration. Now there's been a counter-response to that
led by the rise of Reform and other such parties, which has pushed it way up the political agenda and brought it down again. So interestingly, with migration, it's very, well, Madeline, correct me if I'm wrong, relatively easy to see how it's played out into mainstream politics. So hold that question for a second, because it seems to me on the economy, on the economy, virtually nothing happened. The UK just carried on regardless. And so I want to probe that issue second, but am I right that migration impacts are pretty easy to chart, aren't they?
Yeah, I think there are different types of migration. And one of the things I think that the last few years has illustrated is that there are some types of migration where the government pulls a lever and something happens. The lever is attached to something, right? And so we had that with work and study. Boris Johnson's administration liberalised, we had an increase. Then Rishi Sunak's restricted, we had a decrease. And sort of broadly speaking, the system, I won't say it was totally under control, because, the care visa was not under control. That was pretty chaotic. But the system did what people more or less, it made sense. Then there are other parts of the immigration system that are much harder to control. Policies have an influence, but it's not that same thing where you pull the lever, the numbers go up, the numbers go down, right? So especially when it comes to the asylum system, because people are entering illegally and then effectively being legalised through the asylum system, that is just by its nature much harder. And so I think that what we've really seen over the last few years shows, because obviously this is what, it's about take back control, right? And the government did take back a lot of control of migration. It didn't exercise it in the way that everyone thought that they were going to, but it had that control over part of the system, and the rest of the system, and the bit that has now become most divisive is asylum and small boats, where, there are levers and sometimes they have an impact, but they don't have as much impact as the government would like.
But crucially, the sort of normal, I think that what many, Stephen, correct me on this, those who voted for Brexit wanted was a more direct impact on the way British politicians and Parliament made decisions, and that would have a relatively swift effect. Nobody else could be blamed, and that's sort of, apart from big increase, what happened. But with the economy, and there were economists for Brexit who were, it's a cliche, and wanted to turn Britain into a kind of freewheeling, open economy with low tariffs. They would have radically altered the economy. And yet the most surprising thing about the post-Brexit economy is that effectively nobody did a couple of tiny trade deals. Nothing else happened, did it?
Some trade deals quite big. I mean, joining CPTPP is potentially huge. Forgive me, Tony, because this is I'm not having a go at you, but this is the sort of thing that happens with the... This is why we've got this embrace framework, because sometimes a little thing gets said, and you didn't mean to trigger me, but my amygdala, but my amygdala's kicked in, and now I've got to go. It's going to take me a few minutes to not be wound up. And this is one of the problems with social media, because when the amygdala kicks in, you're now psychologically in fight mode, and then people get on and tweet, and then before you know it, somebody's tweeted back, and everybody's amygdala's got in. Much better to just go, do you know what? I'll answer you in a minute, Tony. But to answer you now,
keep going.
The point is that the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership did at one point have the USA in it, and it's the Pacific Rim trade deal. But what it delivers is free trade without political integration. Now, I am a classical liberal free trader, but I would like that free trade to be associated also with democratic accountability of political power. So for me, it's a very big deal that the UK has joined CPTPP. I worked incredibly hard to make it happen. Although I wish I'd been Secretary of State, that's another story for another day. But I'm on the record on it in several places. But we have turned that now into a potentially global platform for free trade without political integration. I think that's hugely significant. And in the end, where the growth is going to come from in the world in the decades ahead is going to be the East. So there's huge trade problems to solve. But I think that one in particular is really quite big. And just on economists for Brexit, they are basically libertarians like me. I would love for us to go for Singapore without the bad bits of Singapore that I disapprove of, like authoritarianism socially. But Singapore's done amazingly well economically. It's a small territory without much natural resources. We could learn a lot. But the welfare state is now entering into a long period of default, which I believe has already begun. It's in the OBR's official forecasts. We need to do something dramatically different. That will involve regulating our economy to be pro-competitive and pro-growth and go for free trade. And so I'm afraid, sorry folks, particularly at the London School of Economics, we've got to start thinking quite differently about economics and how we regulate, because of some of the admirable social goals we have are, I'm afraid, leading us to default on those social goals, because the welfare state is now not affordable and it's in all the charts.
Okay, very good. Anand.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple of things about immigration and a couple of things about the economy. I mean, firstly, on immigration, if Boris had put vote Brexit, get a million more Indians on the side of a bus, half my family would have changed their vote overnight. I mean, it's like, there's a Brexit benefit for you. But as a political scientist, perhaps, I mean, the most interesting thing about the immigration debate for me is the way it was utterly nullified after the referendum. And we forget this sometimes, because numbers, I think, stay pretty constant after the referendum. There wasn't an immediate massive shift in the numbers post-referendum over 2017, 2018, 2019.
The EU numbers immediately went down, but it was cancelled out. Yeah. Already non-EU was increasing.
But what you found was public concern about immigration dropped. The number of people who had positive attitude towards immigration went up. We had two elections in 2017 and 2019 where immigration was barely mentioned. And, you know, that is a remarkable thing. And so that does speak to the fact, as Tony intimated, that there was something about the control argument here. That actually, by removing freedom of movement, some people at least had ceased to be as worried about immigration as they were without a reduction in numbers. So that's just an interesting thing. On the economics, just a couple of things. I mean, firstly, yes, Steve, growth is in the East. We're not. And, I mean, it's... That wasn't that profound, but thank you. But the point is that, you know, if there is a... I'm no great fan of economics or economists, for that matter, but the one thing...
Good job you're here.
Yeah, I never feel comfortable here. You know, the one rule of economics that seems borne out by all the empirical evidence is that trade is correlated with distance. OK? We trade more with countries near us. Until 2011, I think it was a fact that we traded more with the Republic of Ireland than we did with Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa combined. And that's not because the Republic of Ireland was growing faster than their economies. It wasn't because the Republic of Ireland has a bigger economy than it. It was because the Republic of Ireland is next door. So trade deals with countries a long way away are going to have to do an awful lot of heavy lifting to compensate for trade barriers with a market 22 miles across the channel. So that's the first thing. The second thing on deregulation, again, I think this is a really interesting question of politics, because the original Tory Eurosceptics, if you go back to sort of post-Maastricht, those people, the Fresh Start group, they had a very clear agenda, which was the European Union overregulates, it makes us uncompetitive, we need to get rid of some of these rules that tie our hands. You know, there were emblematic pieces of law that the Eurosceptics would talk about, like the Working Time Directive. We need to get rid of all those pieces of law. And so what we need to do is leave the European Union and then we can scrap these bits of law. The problem was that to win the referendum, those people needed to form a coalition with a bunch of voters who quite like the welfare state, economic regulation, workers' rights. Those red wall voters weren't out there saying, could you strip me of my employment rights, please? So the paradox was, to accomplish something which was a means to an end, you had to ally with people who didn't share your objectives. And I think that's what happened when the Conservatives were in power post-referendum. The Working Time Directive is still on the statute book. I mean, if there was one thing that wouldn't have been on my Brexit bingo card, it is that one piece of regulation about which we heard so much would still be on the statute book 10 years after we voted to leave. And that's because it is very... I mean, ultimately, the British public, and they might be wrong, and I have a degree of sympathy with Steve saying we need to learn to regulate our economy differently and better, but the British people, if you poll them, are very, very European in their attitudes towards regulation. They don't want chlorinated chicken. They don't want hormone-fed beef. They're a little bit more precautionary in their approach to regulation. Sorry. And that's a dilemma if you believe that the point of Brexit was to deregulate. Over to you, Steve.
Well, just on those two points.
Well, very briefly, because I want to ask
Anthony. It's a classic of the genre. Politics is a terrible thing for propaganda. It's a word we don't use often enough. The lettuce that we get from the supermarkets is washed with a chlorine wash that's stronger than is used on the chicken, if my memory serves me correctly. And with beef, if you eat a bull that's not been castrated, you'll have an undefined amount of hormones in it, which will be higher than the amount that is used in hormone-treated beef that's been castrated. Go and have a look at the work of Shankar Singham and others. But the problem is people are terrified by what they've heard. Because, of course, they, you know, it's, again, it's, I don't like to use the word, the L word, but it's an old saying that a lie has gone twice around the world before the truth has got its boots on. And by the time somebody said, oh, it's chlorine-washed chicken, oh, no, not chlorine-washed chicken.
Just in my defence, I didn't say the public were right. I said this is what the public...
I'm not having a go at you. But this is why I'm doing the work with Paul.
Okay.
We've ended up so entrenched in our beliefs, and some of those beliefs weren't actually based on evidence, and it's crippling us.
Okay, Anthony.
Well, I think...
No, I want to ask you something else, actually.
I'm just going to go back to the vote. On the 23rd of June 2016, what were people voting on, and what was the information in their heads, and to what extent was... emotion trumping their detailed understanding. I mean, it is like football teams for many people, as Steve may or may not disagree with this, that people made up their minds and then found the facts that then fitted in with their thesis. That is unlike some of what happens in public life. And so and it didn't help that Michael Gove talked about experts. I mean, it didn't help. And universities, you know, there is truth. There is truth. Something is either right or wrong. Something is either good or bad. Something is either, you know, and we're losing sight of that. And social media doesn't help. And leaders around the world don't help when they do not speak the truth. Universities are there with a profound commitment to discover and communicate the truth. And so I think that it was just such an unholy mess, that referendum, and because we didn't know what we were voting for, we didn't know what was fact, we didn't quite know what was true. In the book, I've got one of the economists, and there are quite a few, who thinks that Britain is stronger outside, and then there is Paul Johnson and writing, and he's quoting a Brexiteer economist back in 2016 who says the hit on the British economy has been between 4% and 6%. So they disagree, and I'm slightly sympathetic and on economics for probably a different reason. I'm not that keen on economics because that's because I never understood it, really. I mean, I did it for my first degree. I'm still battling. It's beginning to make sense of it. But, you know, why are they disagreeing over things as fundamental as how has it been a net effect? I think for all that, the impact on small businesses, I mean, there have been a lot of losers and some gainers.
I mean, quite a lot. And the thing is that we're now looking at Brexit in the context of, I make it up, 5 once-in-a-generation big events, of which it is but one, and disentangling it from 2008 and Putin's invasion of Ukraine and all of that is now impossible. But the question I wanted to ask you, before we open it up to the audience, is that, I think Anna, one of you mentioned, you did actually, 6 or 7, soon to be 7 prime ministers since the morning after the Brexit vote. And that, you know, degree of instability, let's not even ask the question.
Can I say that Burnham has not been deposed yet as the Prime Minister? give him a chance.
You're heading in the direction of my question quite quickly. But the point is, do you think this rapid succession of Prime Ministers, I'm not asking is Britain ungovernable, that was a stupid question, but is itself a consequence of the kind of challenges that were immediately thrown up and have never quite gone away? Obviously, for Theresa May it was, but beyond that...
So, very quick answer, because we want lots of people, 400 in the audience, and each have 7 questions. So, that's 2,800 questions. And I think that, look, it's a debate. Some people think the decline in quality of the Prime Minister is simply not there with the Blairs and the Wilsons and the Thatchers and the Macmillans and the Majors. And other people think it is because the job has got too darn difficult, the lack of growth, the size of the debt, managing the size of the debt, which is eating so much of GDP, and the fragmentation that are now, well, everyone's been talking about. But it's certainly bad. Tony, it is extremely bad for continuity of policy, for long-term thinking. Other countries didn't have Brexit, but they've also had a rapid churn. 2024 was a terrible year for incumbents across Europe and beyond. They lost. They didn't have Brexit. So Brexit, both symptom, cause, and effect of the churn. I do think, in a real way, that there has been a decline in quality of the prime ministers. I do not think, controversial perhaps, that Keir Starmer most recently had the emotional intelligence or the adaptivity of mind to understand, and the lack of curiosity to even find out. He did not talk to historians. Peter Hennessy and I set up the Institute of Contemporary British History to help bridge this gap between those who make history and those who, and politics and those who studied it. I initiated an Institute for Government report into how you run the centre. David Cameron had the Institute for Government giving advice to his ministers on how to handle red boxes. There was none of that sense at all. So I think there's a diminution in the quality and curiosity, and we are all the losers. For all that, you know, he did his best, and so did others. We need to do better, though.
But you're, I think you're saying, by implication, that, yet again, Brexit wasn't Brexit alone that's triggered this. It's Brexit's a symptom in a bigger story.
And it was the biggest thing for the Conservative Party. I mean, the Conservative Party had the tariff reform debates and the Corn Law debates. This was the biggest and the longest, ripping aside the Conservative Party in its entire 190-year history. So I think it was both cause and effect, but there's something more than just Brexit. You know who the great prime ministers are in history, and picking them out from different parties: Lloyd George, Churchill's great, Thatcher, Clement Attlee. They prevail over the crisis. Indeed, all the great, the biggest, most successful history-making prime ministers in history of the 58 have all been there at moments of massive historical consequence and difficulty, and they have been able to meet up. You know, think about F.D. Roosevelt, for example, both in peace and in war. So, you know, I think there's something there. I think it is part of the quality, it's part of the circumstances, it's partly Brexit, but it's much more than that.
Okay, be good. Right, now, I'll take the questions three at a time. Hand up over there. You've got my attention very soon. That's good. One here and one there. Let's make it different. So, there, right over there first. You had your hand up. Keep it up. Wave. That's it. Good.
The answer to the first question is, of course, it was much too defensive and he should not have brought on the defenders and kept a much more attacking strategy.
Over to you, right? If you want to say who you are, feel free to. You don't have to.
Yeah, so I work in the financial sector, and I had a question for Steve Baker. You said that you quite liked the model of Singapore, and I just wonder if there was some sort of short-sightedness in this with Brexit, because there were basically bidding in Frankfurt, Brussels and Paris for financial institutions that were operating in London and then moved to Europe, the EU, because they could no longer operate within the UK due to Brexit. And it meant also that American banks that benefited from the language in the UK then also left to other places like Frankfurt because they no longer had access to the EU through the UK. So what was the plan for that? Because if we're modelling over Singapore, which, I mean, is all services, and the UK was mostly services. How did you plan to mitigate that?
Very good. Okay, yeah. Very clear. Wait, I want to do three, but there's a very clear question about the impact on the financial services. Gentleman in the red T-shirt there. Bad word. You almost disappear with the red behind you. But, yep. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm a master's student at the London School of Economics. I had a question for you, Anand Menon, about kind of, you mentioned about identity and how today politics in Britain is kind of influenced by identity. And I just wondered what, in your opinion, how did it shape, for example, politics in Scotland, particularly in the debate of a second referendum, and given the fact that most of the Scottish population voted to remain?
So you're to the impact of the Brexit vote on opinion in Scotland, right?
Indeed.
Okay, very good. And there was another... Yes, that was it. This gentleman here. Yeah, very good. Make yourself known.
Hi, Martin Newson. I'm so old. I left here in 1988. I want to test my dinner party theory on the panel. I have this view that the British population is too left-wing to take advantage of Brexit freedoms. And therefore, and I'm going to use the word, it was quasi-moronic from an economic perspective to vote for Brexit. So I'm all in favor of deregulation and I don't like the EU and blah, blah, blah. But I just thought it was never going to work from an economic perspective because we're so left-wing. What does the panel think about that?
Right. Well, there's a good three excellent questions. Steve, the first one's... Well, you can try the third one as well if you want. Well, actually do. But try and keep it short. City impacts, were they planned for? And are the British too left-wing to benefit from Brexit?
Well, in the interests of brevity, I hope you'll forgive me if I'm going to end up inevitably giving you an unsatisfactory answer. I'm not going to gainsay your experience. Of course, there has been some redistribution of activity, but I know I've read in the newspapers how well the city is doing, that it's bigger than it was at Brexit. We'll have to talk about it afterwards and compare our evidence. But I know I've been to the city yesterday to talk about the deal I might do through somebody at Lloyd's, and it's all looking pretty vibrant, and I've read the... stories in the newspapers that tell me it's bigger, but we'll have to discuss it. But has there been change? Yes. Was it planned for? No. We'd have to have a much longer conversation about what it's actually like being a backbench MP and what these campaigns are like. The one thing I'd say to you is I know that after the election, George Osborne and David Cameron wanted to get the referendum done by Christmas. That was completely implausible. They got it done absolutely as quickly as they could. They wanted to get this political problem out of the way. Everyone knew Remain would win. I was always being asked, will you accept the result, very condescendingly, and I should have replied, yes, I will, but will you? And big mistake. But that created an absolutely headlong rush to build a campaign, have a campaign, and it would have been far better to take the change or go document that Business for Britain had done, which is that thing. Everyone says there was no plan. It was 1,000 pages, that plan. It would have been far better for that to be picked up by the Department for Exiting the EU as it was when I was a minister and before I was a minister, and to have elaborated it before asking the question. But it wasn't done because everyone knew Remain would win. Everyone knew Remain would win. And so they rushed at it to get it out of the way. Stupid. I know Northern Ireland better than Scotland. And I can't really comment on Scotland, but I did go on holiday in Lancashire to do some skydiving, and an enormous guy from Derry, he would have said, because he was a nationalist, came and wanted his photo with me and his kids, because he said, I'm going to tell everybody you're the man who's united Ireland. Yeah. So that was serious, and I wish I could run into him again, following my apology, when I plainly am not the man who's united Ireland, but by the by.
And
the public definitely are too statist. I am a classical liberal to libertarian. It is undoubtedly the case that the public are too statist. I would like to persuade the public to be libertarians. I would like them to be libertarians of the Austrian school, because what is wrong with our society, above all, test me on it later, is inflationary fiat money, which is now in collapse. If you look at the charts, money's lost almost all its value since the year I was born, and that is what is sowing more despair and dissent before and after the referendum. I'm so relieved that at the LSE one or two people are nodding. It's a big problem. Money's collapsing. The public
voted David Cameron back in after what was called austerity. They did not expect to win, but they won anyway. I couldn't see you now. So they weren't too left-wing to vote us back in. And of course, the experience of Margaret Thatcher is people didn't like, as Mark Littlewood often says, they didn't like the idea of free market reforms before they were done, but they liked the result afterwards. And what we need in this country is politicians who understand the importance of robust, high-quality ideas before they start doing things. I am an aerospace and software engineer to my core. As a chartered aerospace engineer, you would not want me to start fiddling with the aeroplane you're flying on without knowing how it works. I cannot believe the ignorance of politicians I work with. I thought I had only read narrowly before I became an MP, and I quickly found that I was one of the most widely read members of Parliament. Admittedly, I'm only widely read in libertarian and Austrian school theory. I tend to read critiques of Keynes, not Keynes, but I'm quite widely read. But politicians don't bother with ideas, and then they start doing things, and then we wonder why it's a disaster. I absolutely have faith in the British public that if a politician went before them and set out the facts plainly about where we are and what needs to be done and why it's in the public interest to do certain things, I have enormous faith that the public would go with a programme to get this country on the right track.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Anna. It's okay, don't as to what, Scotland's
really, I mean, a couple of points on Scotland. I mean, firstly, yep, the majority of Scots voted to remain. One of the things we forget is, you remember Jeremy Corbyn got all that grief because 36% of Labour voters voted leave. I think 35.5% of SNP voters voted leave. So Scottish politics was very complicated. But what happened post-referendum was the Scottish electorate resorted itself. So basically you ended up with two broad camps in Scottish politics. One was pro-independence, pro-remain. One was anti-independence, pro-leave. And basically people were guided by their Brexit identities, I think, to switch sides in the independence debate, and vice versa a little bit. So you end up with two relatively coherent camps. Problem for the SNP is those two camps are hovering around 50% each, which is where it's been for a while now. So that it doesn't mean that there's suddenly a majority for independence. It just means that Brexit has played a role in reshaping the electorate for obvious reasons, okay? If you want Scottish independence, you probably want to be inside the European Union because it feels safer being an independent Scotland inside the European Union than marooned by yourself. But that's what happened, is basically Scottish political identities have been resorted because of what happened because of Brexit.
Okay, let's take... I know others want to speak, but yes, question there, and then here, and then in the middle there, right? Yes.
Hello, thank you, first of all. I'd be interested to hear what the panel has to say on the effects of young people, specifically given the fact that young people voted overwhelmingly to remain. And Madeleine, I suppose, on the movement of young people, especially to and from European countries, it's something that, you know, no longer has a possibility, at least for my generation. So would be interested to hear what the panel has to say on that. Thank you.
Okay, and it'd be quite good also, Madeleine, you may have a view on whether what the public thinks about the proposals that are now doing the rounds. And if you, anyway, we'll come back to that in a second, because there were this gentleman here, yeah, down towards the front.
Thank you for the great discussion so far. So I think one of the things that I think you've all alluded to without saying is that I think a sign of our era, which is reflected in Brexit, but more broadly, is like our discomfort with like grey. We want black and white decisions, right? And so, like Steve said, well, we could have put a plan forward at first, and then we'd have more of a black and white decision, but we'd know what we were voting for. But I guess my question is how come we ended up with a quite extreme version of Brexit? Because actually, even though I'm a Remainer and pro-European, like if that was the will of the people, fine, but we didn't necessarily have to, you know, go to the extreme. And why is it so difficult for our politics today to just say, to have so many sacred cows that cannot be, you know, broken and overstepped?
Very clear, very good question. And where did I promise somebody else? Oh, yes, there.
Thank you. Just about the lessons of political representation and voice. So prior, and this is to anyone who wants to comment, prior to 2000, working class voters broadly voted in the same turnout as middle class, maybe 5-point difference. After 2000, working class voters stopped voting in large numbers, up 20 to 30% turnout. So they became effectively voiceless. Couldn't get any UKIP MPs voted in, even though they were getting 14% of the European elections, I think, and then Andor remembered at that time. Mm-hmm. So you had a chunk of people with quite highly nativist views, maybe, you might say culturally nativist views, who just stopped voting, said, there's no one listens to me. And if I vote Labour, I'm overwhelmed by the Islington voters, and if I vote Conservative, the Conservative technocrats' voice get heard, not mine. So is that still relevant today, or do we think we've solved that problem of everyone feeling, even if the world's terrible, at least I get a voice if I'm working class, nativist minded Brit?
And actually, it certainly, to your point, attracted the attention, the Leave vote attracted the attention of people in the Labour and Conservative parties who had never really taken any notice of that section of the electorate before. But I'm just saying that from the chair. Who'd like to have a go at these?
Madeline.
Yeah, on the point about the movement of young people, this came up a fair amount in the campaign, and one of the challenges was that, so I think obviously free movement allowed British people to go to Europe. A lot more Europeans took advantage of the opportunity to come to the UK and the vice versa, which is actually precisely what you'd expect, because there are just a lot more of them, right? Their population, the rest of Europe is much, much bigger than ours. I think one of the things I probably would have predicted and been wrong about at the time was, they'll do a youth mobility scheme, right? The UK already has youth mobility schemes with Australia and Canada. And so Europe will get added to this, and in some ways that's an elegant solution, because you have a lot of the most unpopular bits of free movement was the fact that there was no numerical limit, there was immediate access to welfare benefits, people could bring family members. Youth mobility doesn't do any of that. It's much more restrictive, but it does still provide people those opportunities to move. In practice, it didn't happen, I think, partly because just initially the relationship with Europe was quite bad. Europe has always been quite... The European Union has been very keen on the idea of youth mobility for young people in Europe to come to the UK. But also, I think the EU negotiating position has been so unrealistic that it's just been very difficult to agree anything. So the EU is, you know, proposing things like totally uncapped programs, free tuition if people study university degrees, all of these things that effectively that the government just can't possibly accept. So I think that probably eventually there will be some form of youth mobility deal, but it's here we are 10 years later, it hasn't happened. I think partly because of just negotiating the details of it and the sort of quite big gulf still between what the EU is demanding from the UK and what the UK is willing to do is quite big.
Very good. Anand.
I want to answer just something on young people and something on the question about UKIP. On the young people thing, I think there's a really interesting and really important class element to the debate about freedom of movement. And that's because if you go back to the time of our membership and you listen to the debates about freedom of movement felt and sounded like something that was done for the middle classes. So the kids who go to university could go and do Erasmus, you know, I can go and do a lecture in the European Union, lawyers could go and ply their trade across the European Union. But at the same time, it felt like something that was done to blue-collar workers, because what they got from freedom of movement was, as far as they were concerned, people coming over here undercutting them, right? And we never equalised that, and we never thought about that. And so, actually, one of the worst bits of the referendum debate was when a colleague of mine, who I won't name, wrote a piece in the newspaper. We had a big fight about this, because I wrote a response, basically saying, oh, my God, if we leave the European Union, we'll lose Erasmus, right? And I wrote in my reply, I was a bit of a bad-tempered reply, I don't think the average voter cares whether Penelope can go to Provence or not, to be honest. And I think there is a real... Because the number of rooms I have been in over the last 6 months where officials have been talking about youth mobility, where on the EU side, they're telling stories about their kids who can't afford to come to London anymore. This is elites wanting to send their kids to universities, is how this debate is being framed. And I think we need to find a way to make this seem like we're talking about the whole of society. And I think that's really important. I'm not saying student exchanges are a bad idea. I'm saying it's not rocket science why the divide in our society in politics now is between people with degrees and people without degrees, because a lot of these debates are implicitly couched in those ways. Anyway, which takes me to UKIP. I don't think the reason why UKIP weren't getting seats was because people weren't voting. The reason UKIP didn't get seats and got, you know, almost 4 million votes in 2015 and one MP was because First Past the Post punishes a party whose voters are spread equally throughout the country. So I think the SNP got half the number of votes that UKIP did in 2015, and the SNP got 50-odd MPs and UKIP got one. That's just about geography and First Past the Post. But this brings me to Brexit, where I think there's a really sad story about a missed opportunity here. In the referendum, I think 2.8 million people voted who could have voted in the 2015 election but didn't. And one of the great triumphs of the Leave campaign was actually getting people who'd either never voted or had long ago given up voting to actually go out and vote, right? And one of the things you saw immediately post-referendum was, if you look at the measures of trust in politics, people who generally had never trusted politics, and that tended to be Leavers, suddenly had huge faith in politics. Their trust in politics went up. The other side, it went down. And by 2019, that had reached its apogee. And then what you find is everyone now distrusts politics. And in that sense, it's a really sad story of a very, very badly missed opportunity. Because in a sense, the referendum alerted us to the fact that there were all these people out there who were really quite unhappy with the status quo. And we failed to address it. Actually, I'll just say one final thing, which is, and this is one of the, there are so many counterfactuals about Brexit, but this is the one that haunts me. I really think that if we hadn't have had COVID and Boris Johnson had been Prime Minister, we would have seen some progress in the levelling up agenda. And that could have been transformative for the country, because I'm pretty convinced that Boris Johnson would have borrowed to invest in those parts of the country. And he would have done so knowing that that was the way to get re-elected by those Leave-voting people who'd voted for change. And actually, of course, because of COVID, we ran out of money, so we couldn't do it.
And this is, not forget, the extreme version of Brexit question.
Oh, well, yes, that's my fault, definitely. So first thing is, I put this slide up, this one I prepared earlier, very much to Anand's point. I'm going to just run through this because I don't want to do it twice. There's COVID. Everyone can see COVID. That was the big economic event since we voted to leave. So this is GDP indexed to 100 back in 2016 at the time of the vote, and I've just went to Our World in Data and pulled this off. I point out another couple of things apart from COVID. There is an economic outlier that is underperforming, and it is Germany. We are in the middle of the pack of comparable countries, and to believe that we would have grown, that we've missed out on 8% of GDP, which is what one of the worst models says, you'd have to believe that if we'd stayed in the EU, instead of being there between France and Italy, we'd be up with the United States. Now, I work really hard to see the other guy's point of view. I do. That's part of the provocation, people. But I cannot understand why people are getting angry that we're not 8% of GDP higher up, because I just don't think it's plausible when you look at the actual data of how it's worked out. But I'm going to take that away, because otherwise...
Before you stop, Anna was whispering in my ear, he wanted to respond to that.
Just on that. I agree on the 8% figure, actually. It's silly, and the scenario it's based on makes no sense. But the argument that Germany is doing worse than us, so Brexit was okay, is not a logical argument.
That's not what I'm saying.
Germany
is
doing terribly badly because its export markets have been hammered. Yeah. All right, the whole basis of its economy is being questioned. We are obviously doing quite well because post-COVID there's been a massive boom in services. Again, just because the City of London is bigger than it was at the time of Brexit doesn't mean it's bigger than it was because of Brexit.
No, that's why I didn't argue that.
So there has been, and it's measurable now, a significant Brexit impact on our economy, but I agree with you that it's nowhere near the scale of 8%.
So this is exactly the conversation which we ought to be having, because I'm not really disagreeing with Anand here.
No.
I'm not disagreeing with Anna.
GDP per head or overall GDP?
So if you look at GDP per head, you get a different picture to this one.
GDP per head.
But again, GDP per head, you talked about care workers coming in very large numbers, and they're not very high paid people. And again, I appreciate you nodding. But can I try and answer some of the other questions?
Just briefly, because we're getting... Yeah. I want to take
young
one
people,
more
out. Young people, I absolutely despair of some of the things which were done by people who are not Brexiteers. One which completely, it's not directly young people, but completely worsened the debate, was putting citizens' rights on the table. Theresa May did that. I nearly resigned as soon as I became a minister. It was obviously toxic to the debate. It completely poisoned the dynamic. It shouldn't have been done. Likewise, for me, so long as we had control, I was very relaxed about young people going to, and very good on them, go and enjoy Europe, brilliant. We could have been so much more optimistic and confident and given so much more that would have been harmless to the fundamental Brexit cause if we'd just been confident as Brexit is. I mean, I'm sorry I wasn't Prime Minister. I think I would have done a better job. On the extreme Brexit, it really is my fault that we've left this way. With a free trade agreement, which is tariff-free, quota-free, which sorted out the single energy market on the island of Ireland, and so on. You know, this is not a no-deal Brexit. But insofar as you can characterise it as extreme, here's the thing. From the point of view of people like me, the European Union is a structure defined by law. If it's anything, it's a structure defined by law. If you're in its structures of law, you're in it. And if you're outside it, you're outside the structures of law and jurisprudence. And to me, this is like, again, I kind of found myself just tuned to a different wavelength. If you're going to be out of the EU, you are not in its jurisdiction and not under its laws. And that means you're not in the customs union and you're not in the EEA. The only countries in both are EU member states. And it's just like... So that one, it is my fault that we've left into an amazing free trade agreement, yes. And I think I could have done better if I'd been the Prime Minister from the start.
OK, I'm just...
OK,
sorry,
so on the economy, look, read the book. You've got Patrick Minford, who is arguing that it has been an economic neutral or economic success. And you've got Paul, and he's a very distinguished economist. Then you've got Paul Johnson, latterly head of the IFS, and Andy Haldane, former chief economist of the Bank of England, saying the impact has been a negative 4-6%. Read what they say, make up your own mind. On young people, I don't actually agree with Anand here. I don't think it is all about Dominique going off to Marseille for her gappy year. I think it's about all people. I mean, 71% plus of young people, of under 25s, voted Remain in 2016. Now, 75% plus of young people support Remain. That is, if you go to state schools, I spend my life in and amongst young people, their connections with young people and European young people and being part of that great European continent and adventure, I think has suffered. And I think the quality of education in the baccalaureate policy of education in Europe is something we need to learn from. We have an incredibly narrow, sick, exam-obsessed curriculum, which is preparing young people pretty well for the 20th century. We need to have a much more holistic education that's developing the head, the hand, and the heart.
I think the good news is the new Prime Minister has some sympathy for that view, does he not? But
he's still the new Prime Minister. He's still there.
OK, we're going to have to take two more questions because we need to finish at least dead on time, if not a moment or two earlier, to allow Anthony to sign some books up at the top there. So, gentlemen here.
And the others to sign books, because they actually wrote it.
And the others to sign, everybody can sign books. And because you've got a name check, gentlemen at the front, you deserve your...
Hi, I'm a medical doctor and I studied at the LSE. I did health economics. I don't know if this is a good question or not, but are referenda a good way of judging a question of such magnitude in the country?
Can we just ask there, who thinks that the referendum was a good way of... because I'm a populist and I'm going to go with whichever side votes. Who thinks it was a good way to decide an issue of this magnitude? Hands up.
What?
Hands up thinks it wasn't a good way. You know, I'm just thinking recently, it's a terrible way, actually, to
Well, I, I have to ask, anyway, because you are, seriously,
I don't think it was a good point.
You are the literary and the political classes of the country, and you have laid a question that is without sufficient information, without sufficient grounding for the public to make an adequate assessment of what that might mean for them and the consequences for the long term. You've talked about how Brexit has actually changed the nature of the country, its political outlook, its feelings towards its neighbours. It's done tremendous harm and possibly some good. You know, it's been quite heterogeneous, I have to say. But referenda, is that really, are there alternative ways of asking such questions?
There are. Okay, good question. I think we've got you. I think you've answered your own question, but it's appropriate. And he's, and so did Anthony. And what was your name again? You've told
Jeff.
Us.
Jeff.
Jeff, hi. Yeah, I have a nice easy question for the panel. If we had to vote again tomorrow, which way do you think it would go?
Okay, which way do you think it would go? Right, which is a good way of framing it. Okay.
Can I answer this? Because I know I can be quite quick. Referenda are a terrible idea, but they're symptomatic of democracy's biggest problem is it's rational to be ignorant. I usually say indifferent, but the public choice literature says rational ignorance.
And this, and the and, second one?
And the
how
second
would people,
one.
If there was a referendum today?
I would absolutely vote to leave. It's no, all.
Not,
and, but
not
which
how
way
would you vote? How would
oh,
the
sorry,
country
how
vote?
Would it would go? If you, it depends on the question. If you said in or out, they'd probably vote in. But if you said, do you want to have control of your own trade policy, your own regulatory policy, stay out of the... That is what... it's lovely that you laugh, and I'm going to laugh with you. But that's what the polling says. The top line of the polling that you see in the newspaper, and forgive me, this is an LSE audience, look beyond the top line. The top line is the public want to rejoin. But if, as soon as you ask the public... You ask the public, do you want control of our trade policy? Do you want control of immigration? Do you want control of regulatory policy? They want the inconsistent objective that they want control
okay.
of those things.
Short, sharp. Thank you. Madeline?
I'm going to stay out of the non-migration.
Well, I can stay out of the... do you want to answer... say a word or two for the end of the evening, even if it's not on those questions.
Well, so on the point about the referendum, obviously the bigger debate about the referendum, you know, this challenge of, okay, people didn't know what they were voting for, they didn't know exactly what it was going to look like. Certainly on immigration, you know, I'm not going to comment on the other areas, but 100% people did not know that they were voting for a tripling of net migration, right? We're actually now back to a policy that is actually a bit more like what people perhaps thought they were voting for. Asylum is much higher than it was, but that aside, I think we finally got to something that, you know, is more in line with what experts like me were suggesting beforehand, but I think it was not at all clear in the referendum vote to people what immigration policy was actually going to look like.
Would it put you on the spot too much to ask you how people might vote if there was a second referendum now? Is that, given your new role, that's too close to politics?
I assume that they... I would say, even despite what the polling says, I assume that people would vote to stay out if you actually had
okay.
the campaign. But that's
right.
just...
If you actually told them the
no,
facts.
No.
Well,
yes.
if you had a debate right. in a campaign about it, I...
Anthony.
Anand, had we still been in the EU, would we have beaten Argentina last night?
No, because the England team are rubbish at defending. I mean...
Do you want to answer any
I think
questions?
I actually agree almost absolutely with Steve on this, that I think, I don't know whether we vote to remain, to rejoin or to stay out, but the result will be far, far closer than the initial polling, because the process of rejoining will be messy, it'll be a little bit humiliating, and as some of the trade-offs become clearer, the gap will narrow. Well, that too.
Not that one.
No. I was in mid-flow then.
Sorry.
Done.
Okay, right, good. As you mentioned, Lionel Messi. Anthony.
Last word. So how many of you would like another referendum to go back in? Hands up. So that is unanimous. And that was based on a scientific survey. So, look, I don't think the referendum was well conducted in June 2016, not on such a big issue, and I think the core question for all of us is how do we now come together and make the most of our fantastic country?
Very good, a wonderful way of ending. Now, Now, given he's in the news at the moment, I think I'm right in saying that Count Binface, in one of his manifestos, had a policy...
That's a serious guy.
..had a policy of holding a referendum as to whether there should be a second referendum. So he was ahead of you. Now, I don't want any of you to move. Hold on, don't move, because I want the speakers to be able to get out to where the books are so they can do some signing quickly. But I'd like to thank them and thank all of you. It's been a really enjoyable...
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.